With the inception and traction that blockchain and crypto has gathered, the world is possibly on the verge of the largest evolution since the mainstream of the internet. Given the fluidity and dynamic nature of this technology, business leaders, enthusiasts, and veterans all need to band together to navigate the current and upcoming storms. Participants in Web 3.0 want a trusted resource that gives them pertinent information about projects, tokens, technology, and businesses. We are business people talking the business of crypto. We are Y-Whales.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Y-Whales, wherever in the world you are today. So it is June 15th, 2023. Bitcoin is taking a relatively decent downturn right now. I think we're down at 25. We were kind of living for a couple months in late Q1, early Q2, in that kind of, 28 to 30 range. And the SEC and I think the United States government have taken a relatively aggressive approach on cryptocurrencies, especially altcoins. And I think it's just bringing down an overall sense of uncertainty in the markets. That being said, crypto winter is continuing to kind of carry on, meaning that there is less and less investors that are interested in the blockchain space, currently today. However, that doesn't mean in any way, shape, or form that the actual developers and project leaders that are in the asset class already are in any way slowing down. And I think, Aneris, my guest today, is actually going to be a really good example of that, because we've seen the Web3 asset class really expand. When a couple of years ago when we started this podcast, we were heavily focused on cryptocurrencies and NFTs and a little bit in DAOs and some other parts of this. AI has kind of taken a drastic leap forward. It's been around for, AI has been a 20 plus, 30 plus year technology dream. And we saw kind of the rise of ChatGPT just kind of subtly coming on live and being useful. And that's really reinvigorated the space to say, hey, cryptocurrencies, NFTs, and some of the other, big movers from last year's bull market are suddenly, taking the back seat to just chatbots and the overall concept of how can machine learning, which is, again, been around in our everyday lives for decades at this point. But now it's suddenly becoming, true, like, how does this work? How is it going to affect my life, my career, my family? And so I'm really pleased to have Aneris with us today, because we're going to, really talk about where AI is coming in and integrating into blockchain, as well as I'm sure some other parts of the asset class. So Aneris, thank you so much for coming on today. And I'd love to just start with a little bit of your background, where you came from prior to getting into Cube 3, if that's okay.
Super. Absolutely. Thanks. First of all, thank you so much for having me here. I'm delighted to do this conversation. So for background purposes, originally from Lithuania, I've been living in LA for a while, building businesses here, mostly technology businesses. I've had a couple of big successes. I had a couple of big failures. Most recently, I built a company called Cujo AI, which became the default way that ISPs protect, secure their customers against all kinds of cybersecurity threats. So chances are most of you listening to this call are protected by Cujo AI, by way of your ISP. I did that. I also started a cloud optimization company. And finally, I'm here building a Web3 security company that uses AI and many other tricks to make the Web3 space much safer. That company is called cube3.ai.
So I'd love to take a second and let's just, in your minds, because AI is like saying real estate. Like, it can mean a gazillion different things. And so to help frame this conversation, kind of define the way that you look at AI and the uses that you and your companies use it for.
Great question. So cybersecurity is interesting in that arguably it was one of the early industries to pick up on AI. Now, why is that? If you think, 20, 25 years ago, even 15 years ago, when you think of cybersecurity, you're probably thinking of Norton antivirus, right? And what it was a bunch of rules, heuristics. Like, if that happens, then this must be bad. Therefore, let's block that, right? Which was the essence of cybersecurity. About 10, 15 years ago, the nature of attacks became a lot more sophisticated. And the amount of threats just exploded. It was exponential. So you saw companies like Cylance and CrowdStrike emerge, and shortly after, my own company, Cujo AI, And what we all did was we looked at patterns and we looked at behaviors, and we tried to profile those behaviors and patterns with the intent of finding that needle in a haystack, not by way of rules, but by way of algorithms. So in short, AI sort of came to fix cybersecurity problems already a decade ago. And naturally, the AI back then was not as sophisticated as it is today. So, I'd like to think that the industry improved a great deal. So have the bad guys, by the way. They've been, keen users of ML and AI to do exploits. But here we are today, where obviously natural language AI is especially for things such as scams and people pretending to be somebody else, things such as social engineering. I mean, that's, it raises the problem to another level.
It really is. It's you have to fight equal threats, with an equal defense. And so, if when the scammers and the malicious, bad actors are using AI and using it extremely effective. I've seen a number of people kind of posting, here's how they were gotten. And you're right, it's social engineering is easily there. And then you start adding in things like being able to synthesize voice, deep fake, pictures and videos. We are completely, as humans, unable, we do not have the tools to detect, deep fake, phone calls. Because we just want to assume, of course, this is that way the person talks. I'm on the phone with them all the time and it sounds familiar. And we're seeing this more and more times. I think we saw Kevin Rose. It ended up being the hack that he got, where again, I would say he's probably one of the most, forward thinking, understands technology as, he may not be an expert in one field or another, but the dude's been around technology since, the 90s. He gets it. And his attack vector came in through his assistant. That it was a trusted source. They used some very advanced tools to kind of get access to her machine. And then from there, he was kind of defenseless because that's somebody he interacts with every day. So talk me through just a little bit on some of the concepts that you have around, how to frame, the ways you're thinking about AI tools and also some of the most really kind of dangerous attacks that you're seeing right now.
Yeah, so I suppose, broadly, you could categorize attacks in two ways. There are the attacks that use toolkits and exploit methods that can be applied and reapplied and that can be more or less automated. So, you hear things such as phishing or various exploits of smart contracts on chain, or just phishing in general that we're all familiar with, right? So this is a little bit of a spray and pray type of an approach. I have a toolkit, I'm going to deploy it, and I have my assets and I have my money, and I'll go for the masses, right? And then there's social engineering, which is things such as spear phishing and more individualized, more catered, more tailored to that particular victim. And those two problems share things in common, but they're also very, very different. So on the spear phishing, on the tailored, they're trying to exploit you and hack you. There's many basic things that we all know now to do, such as passwords, etc. Going beyond multi-factor authentication, etc. But the honest answer is we just need to build our intuition and learn to be more vigilant as individuals, which is hard. If 2 years from now someone calls you, looks like someone talks like someone but is not that person, right? It is very difficult. Notice that problem. I mean, we've been as an industry trying to, kind of solve already for a little while. If you call your bank, odds are your bank will offer to record your voice. And, they have tools to identify who's who based on your voice. So arguably, there will be a race between who's better at identifying it or who's better pretending to be your voice, right? It's a little bit one of those, new technology. It's still the same game. It's still the same battle between good and evil. But, and both sides are using the same tech to make further advancements. So in short, I wouldn't think of it as like, holy cow, now they have this new tech, the world is over. The good guys have the same tech. So who's going to deploy it better?
Yeah, I'd love to just for, again, quick point of clarification. So standard phishing, which is something we've all kind of grown up with, is there's a form letter. It's for 100% of people. It's the same title. It's the same garbage. You know, hey, your Windows antivirus is expiring. You know, hey, you've long lost cousin has left you money. And it's very easy to kind of crowdsource those types of attacks because the first, you know, 100 or 1,000 people around the world, they get it, mark it as spam and various, you know, whether you're on Office 365 or Gmail, you know, they go ahead and say, from anyone that sent this, just go ahead and pull it out and automatically move it to spam. So crowdsourced phishing attempts are relatively, you know, dead at this point. I mean, we've kind of advanced the technology there. But the new AI spear phishing, which is an entire different, if you can describe some of the attack vectors you've seen, I think that people would love to just hear the framing of how advanced, you know, these techniques have gotten.
Well, so what spear phishing is, you isolate an individual that you want to attack and exploit, and you have a thesis behind it, what it is that you're trying to do. It's a specific account. It's a specific type of an asset, such as you mentioned in the case of Kevin Rose. It's his wallet and what he had there, right? It's, for lack of a better term, it's a business case. And you've got the target, you've got the contact, and you've got a thesis, what they have and how to exploit them. And then you in that business case, you build the best approach. And are you going to make a phone call, such as to that assistant, pretending to be somebody else, using somebody else's voice, especially in the context of a public persona, right? Because as you and I know, when we do wires, when we do payments, when we do wallet stuff that requires real money, we usually say, "Give me a call. I want to verify this transaction with you." Right. Mm-hmm. Well, now I suppose if someone can pretend to be somebody else in terms of voice, that call, now you need to do other ways to do this, right? And you know, technology will catch up, and things will be built in into your phone. I would imagine where the phone will be able to recognize that something's off. But at the same time, again, I I'd love to give like a super AI answer to this, but you got to have sort of vigilance yourself. You got to have clues and tells whenever you're approving a wire. Pretending to be somebody else using fake voice, fake video. Voice is there, video is coming in the context of spear phishing. But basic things, how do you use GPT? You probably give it a bunch of content, you ask it to analyze it for you, or you ask questions and then it analyzes content itself. Well, if I'm a hacker, you know, I have the same problems, right? I need to know who Jay is, you know, let me upload everything I know about him. What does he do? What does he like? You know, what are the clues? So it just makes people more productive, unfortunately, the bad guys too.
Yeah. I mean, data mining, you know, through new AI techniques is, you know, what would have taken days or weeks, you know, is now seconds to minutes to be able to turn around and replicate a very, very quick attack vector. So let's pivot over to Cube 3, because I think it's really a very interesting and novel approach you're taking to, an asset class that you've already spent some time in related to cybersecurity. So yeah, it'll give us the elevator pitch of, you know, what you've been building and why.
So we built a real-time security company for Web3, specifically for businesses that use deployed smart contracts. So if you think about blockchain, obviously, the smart contract is what allows us to code onto the on-chain, right? It allows us to build new type of applications, decentralized applications, you know, serving a variety of purposes and increasing number of purposes, right? But the problem is... $4 billion were stolen from blockchain last year, hacked specifically, two of which, by the way, was allegedly North Korea. So there's a couple of intersecting problems here. There's hackers, there's state hackers, there's a lot of money, there's a whole industry and a whole software that is a smart contract and that is the blockchain. I saw it a while ago. I saw it... over a year and a half ago, I decided to sort of dive into it to understand it better from a hacker's point of view and from a security researcher's point of view. And what I found was glaring gaps, and I built a company to address those gaps.
That's fabulous. And, you know, I think it's, I've said, you know, really since I got kind of really engaged in blockchain, which is, you know, around the 2014, 2015, is that this is not designed for humans. it's great that we can use them, but blockchain is truly the first computer language that you know, and kind of data storage metric that goes past, you know, the Oracles and the AS400s and all the garbage that we kind of built and started deploying in the 80s and 90s that allows us to interact and have true ownership and also data migration, you know, tools. But it expands, you know, infinitely and rapidly. And there's so many different languages that are already being devolved. And I do believe in a chain agnostic world. Like there's 0% chance in my mind that, you know, Ethereum is just going to be anything and everything and every other chain is going to die off. There's different uses for different chains. And so to me, something like what Cube3 is doing, where it allows me to very simply say, I need to interact with, you know, business or product A, B, or C. And I clearly can understand the security risks without knowing Rust or Solidity or any of these other things. Because right now it's the technology so in our face that I think this is critical. How are you, you know, how does this scale? How does it scale across, you know, multiple chains, and where are you guys at now?
So first, I agree with you about multi-chain. I mean, I look at all of them as an alternative to AWS or GCP or Azure. Yep. And I don't know how many will there be, but it will be more than three or four. So our point of view is the weak link in all of this, the onus is on the builder, the person who's deploying, the company that's deploying the smart contract. If they can secure their contract, it means their application is secure. It means you, when you're interacting with that application, that particular chain, you're doing it such in a secure manner. Let me give you an example. If you go and use a lending protocol or some sort of a DeFi protocol, there's a couple of risks. First of all, you make a bad trade and you lose money. That's a risk that you're willing to tolerate, you know, right? The second risk is that contract was exploited by North Korea and they don't no longer have your money, which defeats the whole purpose of DeFi. That is the problem we are solving with Cube3. We work with companies in the space that deploy contracts, that manage value by way of their contracts, and who understand that code security, just code security, before you launch is insufficient. They need a real-time AI-enabled method to evaluate what happens vis-a-vis their smart contracts. And if someone is attempting to exploit them, you know, our job is to defend and reject and decline that exploit so that users like you, the community, you know, can interact with Web3 in a safe manner.
Yeah. And you know, again, I'm continually, because security is kind of a tough one, I think, for a majority of people in the audience to understand, because it is very nuanced. And I've only spent enough time that I can talk semi-intelligently. But blockchain, one of the premises is it's built very much like the open source community. So unlike in the traditional Web2 world, that if, you know, you want to break into, you know, a company's back end, you may or may not even know where they're hosting, where their data is. Are they in Dropbox, AWS, Azure? Like it could be anywhere, and there's, you know, so many different attack vectors and different ways of security. But now we're on blockchain, and everyone can see the code. We can all see the code. We can all audit the code. But are we auditing the code? You know, and is there parts of that code that are adjustable, that it's safe today, but somebody made a change tomorrow, and now there is a hole that they just didn't anticipate? And how quickly can those alerts be sounded? So, you know, to me, it's you know, these are the tools that everyone's poking holes. Like if you've got a bridge, you know, with a, you know, $10 billion sitting in it in wrapped assets, that's a huge target that's just sitting out there. You know, for that people can attack all day, every day. And if they find a hole, I would assume that Cube3 is going to alert the white hats just as fast as the black hats.
Well, not only that, if they attempt to exploit, we'll reject that exploit. So we built a technology that allows applications to defend themselves proactively in real time, automatically against the exploiter.
Well, that's amazing. Talk, dive into that a little bit.
Well, so let me touch on two things you said and sort of expand. One is, I mean, I think you hit it on the nail. When you deploy a smart contract, it's wide open, right? Everyone can see it. everyone can exploit it, which is Eureka. It's for the black hats. I mean, for the I shouldn't say black hats, for the criminals, because now they have they can skip so many steps and they can go straight to the money, and they don't have to ransom you either. They'll just get your money, right? So so it's super compelling. And secondly, as you said, which gets into our product, when you deploy a contract, you first audit it, right? You look at code security. But, you know, all of us have these devices, phones and computers. And notice that every week or so, you get a new security update from Apple or whoever built your phone. Same thing for every other piece of technology around you in your life. It's continuously updated and continuously patched. Why is that? There's no such thing as weeding out every possible risk before you deploy. It's impossible. It's just by definition. Like you said, software is complex. It evolves. It becomes, you know, different. And, you know, to that end, but every single time you code something, you introduce a potential risk to your code. So with all of that said, how do you tackle that problem? Well, part of the answer is after you deploy, you need a layer of defense that looks at what happens, well, equips your application to recognize an exploit attempt and equips your application to say no to that exploit attempt. I'm simplifying things, but in summary, your application is no longer alone, so to speak, in the wild.
Yeah, it's you know, again, I'm doing a lot of framing here because this is a very complex subject of which I think a majority of people don't really understand. So in Web 1, Web 2 development, it's like taking a race car and you build it in your garage. You get halfway done through it. You send it out on the track. You bring it back into the garage and you keep iterating until you finally get it right. And forever, you can keep bringing it back into the pits, changing the tires, adding more fuel, changing the colors. Like it's fine. Web 3, you're launching a satellite into space. And so there are some decisions that you're going to make that you will never be able to change. You're not going to bring it back to Earth and revise that. And so you want to be able to have patches and you want to be able to have security, but there's limits to what you can and can't patch. So what you're describing is Cube 3 sits around the contract. And really describe that a little bit more because I don't want to make assumptions.
Yeah, I think you described it correctly. We have various ways to provide our capabilities to the contract builder and to the application. But essentially, yes, we envelop it, or we become part of it, so to speak. Or our decision engine, our ML, becomes a part of it so that smart contract has these sets of capabilities. That being said, I do see a future where much of what we deploy on chain, the smart contracts, become upgradable. I think and that becomes the norm, the standard. I mean, to an extent, a large part of the industry is already that. And I think one of the reasons why people are hesitant and why they launch the satellites to space is because they want to make sure, like, if we're going to do it this time, I'll remove every possible attack out there and I will launch and I'll never upgrade because God forbid I introduce a new attack vector, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, vulnerability. But that's just—it's hard to run a business like that, you know. There's a reason why we went to the moon 50 years ago. Like, if you can only attempt it every, you know, once in a decade, it's hard, right? So it needs to be a different way. It needs to be you as a developer. You have a business mission to accomplish. You launch, you update, you have your own, you know, just like regular software. We have to be able to advance at the speed of software, not at the speed of, you know, rocket launches.
Yeah, this is a problem that already exists today, and we're still so early in the evolution of blockchain. You know, people are still trying to decide what is blockchain and everything else. So one of the challenges that we face is that people have made protocols in which they said these are perfectly built. You know, they've spent years on designing a bridge or some sort of DeFi protocol, and there's no way to upgrade it, but there's also, you know, no way that someone's going to exploit it. And then the problem is that everything evolves. And suddenly features and benefits that people are go, well, no, I need to have this. This is the new version of DeFi. You now have, you know, Alchemix 1.0, which was designed so perfectly that Alchemix 2.0 was an entirely different, you know, protocol. And he couldn't migrate. He couldn't even say, take the assets. So there's still people's, tokens and investments sitting in Alchemix One, that if they don't interact with it, it won't migrate to two. And so they're kind of stuck there. And so are you able to go backwards, be backwards compatible to some of these old contracts and help bring them back to life in any capacity? In that case, you wouldn't be able to transfer tokens, but
we can secure. Holds. We yeah. can secure any contract, but we cannot migrate folks from one to migration. The other.
Bad example.
Right. Right. I completely agree with you. I mean, some contracts, I have to say, should not be upgraded by design. It's a feature. It's not a bug. Mm-hmm. But in most other cases, I believe that contracts and blockchain software needs to behave like software. And they can and they will if we build a security industry around it so that these builders have tools in their toolkit to protect themselves, to defend themselves. Because mind you, just a year ago, there was nothing other than audits. And over the last year, there's dozens of companies that are tackling various problems of the security layers, including mine. So we're making massive strides as an industry, as a niche that is Web3 cybersecurity. And some of these things you described will be much easier for builders to accomplish. So the net of it will be a more robust industry that is safer to engage with, safer to invest in, and hopefully you will not be, waking up to $600 million hacks.
And part of this is, again, the world is continuing to evolve and change. And I know you've written some articles on kind of, the new hybrid workplaces and work from home, which brings into, for traditional companies, an entirely different attack vector. Because if you're used to, Susie in accounting being able to walk into your office every single day and say, hey, sign off on this wire, or hey, authorize these transfers or this agreement, it suddenly becomes very hard when you're not in the same room. You never will be in the same room. They were hired remotely. You are remote. And so, kind of walk through a little bit of how AI is going to really help dynamically change and secure those integrations into, internal politics.
Yeah, it's been a shift. I would say 5-6 years ago, certainly before COVID, when you spoke to security teams internally at companies, they kind of, to an extent, their job was over when you left the building, so to speak. Maybe you left it with a phone and that phone had some security in place, right? But, to your point, with so many of us working remotely, that perimeter, the security perimeter, now extends to your home environment as well, which is an interesting balance between your home privacy and your employer's security, because that little camera out there could be hacked and that could be an entry point to your work computer. So, and therein lies an entire industry and category of cybersecurity companies. What's fascinating is every time there's a threat vector, the first thing that happens is people come away with a lot of money, the criminals. The second thing that happens is there's a brand new industry full of unicorns that are protecting against that problem. So it's a mad race. Intellectually very interesting to be a part of it. With respect to AI, again, I mean, this is making black hats, cyber criminals more productive. If there's one takeaway, I would leave is, look, we're not fighting against an individual in a garage that is having fun, right? Imagine that organization, could be a centralized organization with an office building, with HR, with recruiting, with marketing their toolkits. They happen to be in the business of stealing somebody else's money, ransoming people, etc. They're professionally run. Or they could be decentralized. It could be a collective, a community. Where engages and works together on dark web, AI makes them more productive, just like your business and my business, right?
Yep.
So if GPT is going to be a leap in your and my productivity, it will be in theirs as well. There's also a whole industry right now of protecting GPT and protecting your models, which we get into it.
AI, we keep hearing, especially Elon and some others, talking about how dangerous AI is. I think it's a very interesting quandary is, nobody says, people say how dangerous social media is and some other things. So it's not the first time, we've heard like danger from some sort of digital interface. What in your mind, let's stick with kind of, we've established there's a lot of AI attack vectors that can happen on blockchains. What's kind of your biggest fears wrapped around AI in general?
I'm actually probably more on the super optimistic side when it comes to ML and AI. The way I think about it is, imagine there is a super intelligence, right? Imagine we get to that point, which for all we know could still be decades away, right? Mm-hmm. Seems to me this is a path to solve some of the problems that are unsolvable in your and my lifetime. I recently read that the company used AI to identify, was it 2 or 3 new antibiotics, which is nuts. I mean, we as, as a world have been speaking about shortage of antibiotics for a while now, and they used AI and ML to kind of narrow down to a couple of candidates, and one of the candidates was absolutely novel. So problems such as disease, I sit on the board of an oncology company called Perthera AI. They look at genomics and various other omics of a patient's tumor to suggest using AI, using pattern recognition, to suggest possible treatments for that particular type of disease. So, sort of the evolution of compute and the compute power, as well as these transformative technologies such as LLMs and transformers in AI, these advancements in research and advancements in capabilities, to me, I see a fantastic future. I can speak to sort of the way I think about risk as well.
Please.
What I've described are tools and technologies and methods. These are not autonomous things that make independent decisions towards some sort of a purpose. I don't know that we've seen any proof, evidence, or signals or indications that what we're dealing with right now is capable of autonomy, independent decision making. So I just want to say that has not happened. And we may not be even ever close to it. That may never happen, as far as we know. So sign me up for AI is good camp.
Yeah, and I think that's really the way that we need to look at this is even with the advancements today, no matter how great it is or anyone claiming artificial intelligence, Terminator 1 and Skynet is true like AI intelligence. It looks and just goes, don't care about any. There's no safeguards. It now has full autonomy. It understanding. It's self-aware, and it's going to make decisions based on what it feels is best, and not worried about who made it or what it perceives as God or any of those types of, quandaries. And so, with that being said, I love the thought that we may never get there, and I think that, singularity is probably more likely to happen than true AI, intelligence probably in our lifetimes in a meaningful way. What's your kind of, as I've got you for a few more minutes, what's your just thesis on where AI is going to go probably over the next, 3 to 5 years?
It's very straightforward. I think my earliest sort of experience with technology was Windows 95. And I always like to think that was the biggest technology leap, in my lifetime so far. Mm-hmm. What came on top of it, on the shoulders of Windows 95, and what that brought, Internet Explorer, Netscape, all of that, right? This feels just as big. I can't think of any work routine and many personal routines that will not be enabled, made better with ML. AI. I mean, everyone is going to have a co-pilot. I'm going to go to the gym and I'm not going to be staring at my graphs anymore. I'll just speak to something and that thing will speak to me and it'll tell me, do more crunches, you know, do better. It'll be your therapist. It'll be your doctor. It'll be, you know, it's all Travis. These things. Exactly. It'll just remember that movie with Her. The movie Her, when Joaquin Phoenix walks around with a little headset.
Yeah.
I think Scarlett Johansson speaks to him all day long, right?
Yeah.
So I'll take her voice to speak to me all day long and sort of guide me for life. I think it's an amazing future. It's still a future where you can, go offline and enjoy your world. It will just remove so much of the mundane and so many inefficiencies in life and at work. It's the most amazing thing. I mean, I think there's certainly a hype. Just every bone in my body, my intuition says that this is so much more than a hype. This is it. This is the next big thing.
And it's a rapidly evolving, like all of a sudden, you know, what was, you know, kind of AI is whatever. Now everything's there. And there's big differences between these, you know, ChatGPT-4, you know, when you went with plugins and with, you know, web enabled is very efficient at doing specific things. Grammarly, you know, is a very basic AI that helps it. And then Grammarly decided to do their own like AI, like we're going to help you, you know, write this stuff. And it's horrible. Like it's utterly unusable. And so we're not there. There's no like, hey, we've reached a baseline and everything just works. You know, it's still going to take a lot of time for people to figure out, you know, how should this be implemented and where can it go? What are your kind of like top use cases today for people that just want to play with AI and get more used to it?
If you're building a business, you'll get the co-pilot to act as your customer service. That's the primary one, which, you know, covers customer services such that you need to do 24/7. There's tools out there already. Intercom has a tool called Finn that you can place a chat on your web and, you know, forever into infinity, it will act as your customer service rep. Amazing use case, right? Mm-hmm. We use GPT internally for all kinds of marketing things, copy, website creation, ad units, etc. If you think about, you know, your team or you, whoever has ever dealt with ad units and buying placements on Facebook, etc. You know, there's a lot of inefficiency. What should you say? To whom you should say that, etc. All that is going to be automated. You'll go into your ad network and you'll say, hey, I need more customers. I'm ready to pay this much. Here's sort of a big picture of what we do and here's who we target. Go get them for me. And it will do, you know, many of the things that need to be done manually. So I think, you know, recruiting is going to be easier, both finding candidates, interviewing candidates. You'll be able to assess better with a co-pilot. I interview everyone we ever hire and all the companies that I've been involved. But man, that first stretch where you have to kind of, eliminate and narrow, that takes a lot of your time. You know, you can be on four calls a day interviewing folks that AI will be able to do for you now. So, and so on and so forth. I mean, the leap here is that the creative work, the thinking in the moment, thinking on the spot work, LLM is pretty good at. And therefore, you know, to those listening here, if I'm running a business, especially like a legacy software business that has a bunch of charts, graphs, and a bunch of buttons to click on, I think frame the question the following way. If you were to start over and you were to do your product, your business built on an LLM, on a GPT, how would you do it? Because the next person to disrupt your industry is already working on it.
Naris, one of, you know, the most engaging conversations I've had, you know, related to AI, because, you know, it's not just a matter of you wanting just to chat, but you're actually trying to secure funds and data. And there's so much that goes into this, and it's going to be rapidly evolving. I'm sure every single day You and your team are learning new attack vectors. You're seeing technology evolve. And technology that you didn't know existed a week ago is suddenly now, infiltrating various smart contracts and databases around the web. So again, just want to thank you for your time and everything you're doing. If people want to know more about Cube3 or any of your other projects, where's the best place to find you guys?
You can go to cube3.ai. For all YPOers listening, they can find me on the YPO portal or just email me at e@cube3.ai.
That's fabulous, sir. Y-Wales, this is Cube3, your AI defense fund or defense protocols for smart contracts and quite a bit more. Anaris, I thank you for your time. Y-Wales, we'll see you guys next time.
Y-Wales was founded in 2021 by Jay Steinbeck, a passionate entrepreneur and business owner, with the purpose of bringing YPO and YNG members together in the cryptoverse. Y-Wales is a collaborative and confidential community centered around cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology, an exclusive crypto hub of more than 600 members. To be notified when we release new content, please subscribe to our show in your preferred listening app. For more information, visit www.ywales.com. Y-Wales is not affiliated with YPO, but at this time only allow for YPO, YPO Gold, and YNG members due to privacy and confidentiality. Support and production for today's episode was done by Truthwork Media. Nothing in the podcast constitutes professional and/or financial advice, nor does any information on the podcast constitute a comprehensive or complete statement of the matters discussed or the law relating thereto.